all, it's an honor to be asked to read, to be up here and lead the meeting. And I'd like to thank Richard for asking me. And it's an honor to fill in for Bob B, you know, and I hope he gets better. It says here I'm supposed to share for 10 to 12 minutes about the speaker. And I don't know, man. I got to share this stuff, I guess, because he's my sponsor. The one thing I got to say that, you know, and I don't want you to take this thing personal, Bob, because I didn't, is that, I don't know, Bob's been sponsoring me for about, I don't know, 7.5 years or so. And a couple months after he became my sponsor, he moved out of the area. And I'm still talking about it, so I don't know if I've got a resentment about that or what. But and then a little while later on, he moved even farther. So, and it's exactly 84 miles from my house to his. But it's an honor to have Bob Stewart as a sponsor. You know, for those of you guys that don't know Bob, you probably will at some time or other if you stick around, and you will see a man that walks like he talks. A good example for this addict and a lot of addicts that followed me and came before me as to how to do this thing called recovery. You know, a perfect example that I always have is the World Convention in Hawaii. It took us about 4 hours to get into the that room to buy some t-shirts and stuff for 4 hours. Only addicts would stay in line for 4 hours to buy a t-shirt. You know what I mean? But we did. And there was Bob in line with us. The man works for the world, man. He could walk in at any time, probably, and say, you know, everybody knows him, and he could just walk in. But he's an example for me that, you know, just because he does work for the world and he's got all this time and stuff, he's just an addict, just like me. And him and his lady stood in line those 4 hours or so. And but he's a good example for me. I was going through some tough time when Bob became my sponsor. My sponsor decided at the time that I had for 12 years, had decided to take a different road, you know. And to this day, I'm just glad that that man that was my sponsor for 12 years decided to come back into the rooms. Well, he never really left, but he was fading away, if you guys know what I mean, and dropped the commitment and stopped going to meetings. And I don't know about you guys, but I have to look up to my sponsor. My sponsor has got to have what I want. And Bob, through the grace of God, ended up my sponsor, man. And I tell you what, this man has always been there for me. He has always not returned my phone calls. No matter what part of the world he's in, he has always called me back. You know? And I never get tired of hearing him speak. And, you know, for those of you guys that are new, man, and if you're new and it isn't your first function, you're pretty lucky, you know, because you have a lot of predecessors in this room right now. And I guess that's why they call it the Day of the Dinosaurs, huh? And, but, you know, it takes being up here and talking to my people. I gotta say it, you know. And at the countdown, you guys will realize what I'm talking about. And, you know, God bless the dinosaurs that came before me. And Bob happens to be one of them. And with that, I'll go ahead and shut up. And it's an honor and a privilege to introduce to you our main speaker for the night, Bob Stewart.
My name is Bob, and I'm an addict, and I have no anonymity. But But if that's the worst thing I have to worry about in my life today, I have nothing to fear. Louie asked me when we were sitting up here, do I still get nervous? I said, I'm nervous right now, and the minute I stop being nervous, I'm screwed. Because then I think I've got a handle on this thing. You know, I don't know about anybody else, but Rick kind of put it, I don't know if he followed in my footsteps in a way, and it kind of, we blended together as a personality almost, but I never know what I'm going to say when I come up to this podium because I don't have a canned pitch. I don't believe in that. I believe in whatever's in my heart and whatever's happening in my life and whatever's happening in my recovery is what I have to share about. And that if I can impart some experience, strength, and hope, then that's the best I can do. And I told somebody else out there, I'm not up here for you. And I've never gotten up to this thing for other addicts. What I've gotten up here for is my own reprieve. I've given myself another chance to get honest with myself. Because that's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in recovery is get honest with Bob. I can get honest with you, but to get honest with me was a very difficult road to follow. And it was a difficult task to accomplish. And it's the opening thing, the eye-opening thing that happens in recovery is that I got honest with Bob. I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'll bounce all over the place because I'm one of them bouncing ball people too. You know, I was a very fortunate child. I was adopted when I was 3 years old, going on three. I wasn't quite three. I'm the product of an interracial relationship in Detroit, Michigan in the early 40s. I'm born in 1942, and that was something that was a lynching offense in those days. I don't care if you were north of the Mason-Dixon or south of the Mason-Dixon. So Bob ended up in an orphanage. But a loving couple wanted a child and could not have one and adopted me and gave me everything that they thought I needed to become better in my life and that I, to make sure that I had things that they, you know, these were people that were adults in the Depression that scuffled, that came from the South where it was hard and came up North and found it just a little bit better. And they tried to give me a good life. They were Christian folks. So they tried to impart some of those principles into my life. But I'm one of those people that believe, and it's not written in the literature of Narcotics Anonymous anywhere, I'm one of the people that believe that we just born doping. I was an addict long before I put a chemical in my body because I had addictive thinking and addictive behavior as a child. I was self-centered. I was self-obsessed. I was one of them, I want what I want when I want it. Didn't matter what it was. I was an isolationist. You know, I would rather be with animals than with people. Because people disappointed me. But what happened was they tried to give me everything that they could to raise me right, to teach me the right thing. But somewhere along the line, the disease took over. I was a good student, but I was not attentive. I was one of those kind of kids that everything came easy for me, academically. Books didn't pose a problem for me. People did. Years later, when I got clean and went back to make amends to my parents, I looked at some report cards when I was in elementary school, and they all said the same thing. I had A's and B's, but on the other side, I had unsatisfactory because I didn't know how to get along with people. I didn't know how to take instruction. I didn't get along well with authority, and that would haunt me all the way to the penitentiary. Because a lot of us have to follow a lot of different paths to get into Narcotics Anonymous. That just happened to be my path. I left home when I was 18 years old and went in the Air Force. My parents by this time were sick and tired of my shenanigans. They had changed the locks on the house a couple times because I lived by my rules and my schedule was not their rules and their schedule. And they just had to say, look, Bob, here's the deal. If you can't live in this house under our rules and regulations, then you need to get your ass out of here. And I think when I went and told them that I wanted to join the Air Force and I had this paper for them to sign, they couldn't sign it fast enough. And their thought was maybe they will make a man out of him and teach him some discipline and make him grow up. But all I found in the Air Force once I got through that boot camp prep was a bunch of guys just like me that like to get loaded, like to go out and party, like to gamble, like to do all that wild, crazy shit, and then try to get back on base on time. They were just like me. There was a new brotherhood of insanity. And it was condoned. You hung out with the top kick. They did the same thing you did, only they knew how to do it. They were slick. They could make muster in the morning easily. Clean shaven, sharp creases, they were ready. That night, they were in the middle of the insanity. And then I did okay with that until I kind of slipped up and broke the law a little bit. I come home to my barracks one day and OSI was there telling me, we want your shit. Open up everything. We want to see what else you got because we already got what we want. And next thing I know, they were escorting me off the base gently. And at that time, that was 1964, I think I moved to what was paradise on earth in the United States for dope fiends, and that was San Francisco, California. San Francisco in 1964 was like God's city in 1880. I mean, it was wild and crazy and wide open. And the flower children hadn't even got there yet. That was to happen later. All these things happened, and the recourses that happened in my life were a result of decisions that I made in my act of addiction. See, I embraced the lifestyle of addiction. Not only did I want to be an addict, I chose to be an addict. I made the decision. When people say, well, I couldn't help myself, that's bullshit. You know, I hear it all the time. Well, I couldn't help myself. Yeah, you can. There was nothing I did in my act of addiction that I didn't have conscious knowledge about and made a decision about on my own. Now, they may not have been the right decisions, but they were my decisions. And I accepted the premise that you paid the cost to be the boss, even if it means jail and institutions and ultimately death. I embraced that as a lifestyle. I embraced that because that's what addicts did. I wanted to be known as a reg, you know, regular, you know, qualified, stomped down dope fiend. And I did everything you had to do to keep that qualification, which included go to jail, keep your mouth shut, do your time, get back out and start all over again. And that went on and on and on until 1978 when I got out on a suicide run and ended up in a VA hospital bleeding out one lung and about dead. And it was at that hospital that I was introduced to a program, a recovery program, and it was in that recovery program that I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. The very first meeting I went to was Saturday Night Live in Venice. That was the social circle of Narcotics Anonymous. That was the dog and pony show. That's where you went to be seen and to see people. You know, there was a little recovery going on, but it mainly was the big social, and that was and it's still a two-hour meeting. That was a long-ass meeting, you know. There were funny people, there were tragic people, but there was recovery there, and there was an attraction there, and it was there that I heard the message for the first time. My mind opened up, and I heard a speaker share their experience, strength, and hope. And the tragic thing about it is they told their story, and I identified not with what they did, but what they felt. And the thing that was more shocking than anything that the person telling the story was a woman named Michelle. And what happened was, like some of us, she had the gift, she got the message, she carried the message, she forgot the message, and she went back out into active addiction. And her husband, a guy named George, was devastated by it. I watched this man with 17 years clean at the time come into the back of meetings and sit in the back and share his pain of what he was going through, walking through that incident that had devastated his life. And I got so much respect out of that, and I learned to respect and love this guy. Little did I know that 17 years into my recovery, I would have to face the same thing. I would have to walk through that same devastating pathway of insanity. You know, every time I come out here, I get reminded of a lot of things. I spent 18 years of my recovery out here in the Inland Empire. I have a passel of sponsees out here. Still, you know, my old home group is in Rancho Cucamonga, and I frequently come out here to help celebrate these guys' anniversaries and their recovery and their milestones. And the things that I went through in my life when I lived out here, I had some very, very high, wonderful, great moments in my recovery, and I had some low points that were devastating. But the one thing that I learned out of all this stuff is that it's the people in Narcotics Anonymous that are the core of what this fellowship is about. You can work all the steps in the world. You can pray to your higher power 23 hours a day. You can go to meetings. But if you don't interface with the people, if you don't give this thing away in order to keep it, then you'll be lost along the way. You will have missed out on the greatest part of this thing, and that's the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. The friendships that we get here. The people that cover our butts when we're running naked down the street on fire, they're the ones that are the most important people in our lives. It was those people around me in my life out here that carried me when I was a wounded warrior and couldn't carry myself. You see, these are the people that are important. And you find them in these rooms. But the only way you find them is you do like someone else said, you make yourself available. I like what my wife Renee has to say from time to time, is that we are a fellowship of people who are socially inept. We don't know how to interface with one another that well. We got deficiencies in that area. And the more time you have around here, it doesn't exclude you from that infirmity. You know, we are not prone to just raise up our hands and say, hey, come over here and get my phone number and blah, blah. No. You know, we are self-absorbed people. So it's up to you as a newcomer to say, I like what that person has to say. Let me go get their phone number. Because believe me, as much as I like to stand up here and tell you that I'm some kind of saint in Narcotics Anonymous, I am not. You know, as much as I like to tell you that I reach out to everybody, I don't. You know, but I do know one thing. If you reach out to me, I had better reach back out to you. Because my life is at stake if I don't. Because I'm lying about what I have, and I'm not telling the truth to me or you. When I was growing up with that family that loved me, my mother and my father, that cared for me, I had all these dreams as a child. You know, I think we all sit on those back steps and look at the stars at night and think about things and wonder about what we're going to be when we grow up. And I was no different than any other child. I had those kind of dreams. And somewhere around the age of about 12 years old, my mother decided that being a maid for other people and a housekeeper was not what she wanted in her life anymore. And she applied for and got a license to be a foster home for the state of California, or the state of Ohio, excuse me. And she started to get these foster kids into the house. I resented all of them. I resented the shit out of them. I did not want to be a part of that program because I was self-centered and self-absorbed. I was the only child. And over the years, she took care of a lot of kids. What happened was there was one child who, most of these kids, their mothers were ripping and running up and down the streets, their fathers were going to jail. Back in those days in Ohio, they had what was called a workhouse. They would go to the workhouse. It was like going to the county jail. Or they would end up going to the Ohio State Penitentiary, and when you went there, you did time. It wasn't nothing about a bullet. It was about a nickel and up. And women were running the streets. They couldn't take care of their kids. The kids ended up in the foster system. This is back in the 50s and 60s. So a lot of these kids came to the house, and there was this one little family of kids that came there, and the mother just couldn't keep them. She had to keep going in and out of the county jail. So they ended up adopting the youngest son, and he ended up being my adopted brother. And his name is Ralph. I want to talk about Ralph a little bit. I didn't know him as a growing up. By the time he came into our house, he was about 4, and I was about 17. I was deep into my disease by this time. I was just getting started, just getting dope fiend traction, getting ready to move on. When I left home to go in the Air Force, he was 5 years old. He was an infant. So he never knew me. What he learned about me happened later on. He was there when my mother would get those letters from those different places in California that had P.O. boxes and numbers on them. He was there when she would get them phone calls, and my dad would get them phone calls, and they would say, "That's your brother out there in a heap of trouble again in California." Or, "That's your brother. This is from your brother. He's asking for money. He's in one of them penitentiaries." That's all he knew about me. Later on, as he grew up, he came through Los Angeles one time when I was deep in my disease. And he showed up. He called me, and he showed up at my door. He was on his way to the Philippines. He, too, had joined the Air Force. He was on his way for an overseas assignment, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and he stopped by my house in West L.A., and I immediately said, "You got any money?" I had him peel out the money out of his pocket, and we proceeded to go directly to the dope house. And I had him sit out there with the connection's parents while I was in the back room doing what we do in those rooms for hours. And then he went on to the Philippines. I ended up back in penitentiary again. I get a letter from him. I'm at CIM. I finally made it to the big time. Minimum security at Chino. I'd been begging him for years.
Let me go down to CIM.
So I'm down at CIM, and he's back now stationed at March Air Force Base in Riverside. And he and his wife and his 18-month-old daughter come to visit me. He rolls her out there in a stroller. And they come to visit me at the penitentiary. His brother, the dope fiend, the convict, the malcontent. He goes on with his life, gets a divorce, moves back to Ohio with my parents. I get clean in 1978. 3.5 years later, I'm doing step work with my sponsor, and he says, "You're in that ninth step, it's time for you to go home. It's time for you to go to Ohio." and take care of some business. So I went back to Ohio to make amends to my parents. And I go back and I was given the opportunity to sit down with each of them and make amends to them. You see, the ninth step is where the meeting, is where the rubber meets the road at in Narcotics Anonymous. You got to cinch up your loins when you get ready to do the ninth step. Because you're going to be asked to do some things that your heart is going to be fearful of, and your mind is going to tell you all kinds of stories about. But you know in your heart you got to do what you got to do. So I was able to do that. I was able to make those amends. The one thing that was so joyous about that, what I've got to describe to you is that when they saw me with 3.5 years clean, they had not seen me in the flesh. My parents had not seen me in the flesh for 20 years. My disease had took me off to the wayside that long. And the only thing that had happened was when I got clean, I began to call and talk to my stepmom, who I didn't talk to for years growing up. But we began to create some sort of a relationship. And it took a while for her, and I could tell it from the way that she responded to the conversations that we had, that in the beginning there was that same shaky, tentative belief in anything I had to say. And gradually over a period of about 2 or 3 years, I could see that doubt, that fear, was beginning to dissipate. And she began to understand and believe me. And when I got there in the flesh and was able to make amends, when I was leaving, my brother, Ralph, took my suitcases and was putting them in his car to take me to the airport to come back to L.A. And I had a moment to stand in the doorway and say goodbye to my parents. And there was a millisecond, just a flickering of a millisecond, that I looked in their eyes. And the thing that I saw in their eyes at that point in time was that they were no longer afraid for me. They no longer believed that they would get a call in the middle of the night that they had found a body in an alley, and it was their son, Bob. The fear was gone. They knew that I had found a path for living that may not have been the path that they wanted for me in the beginning, but it had so many things that were parallel as far as spiritual principles are concerned. And they understood that I had found a way to save my life, and thereby their son was saved. A few years after that, my stepmom passed away, and I was given the privilege to come back and participate in that funeral. And what happened at that funeral was I was sitting in the front pew with my family. Father's side over here, mother's side over here. And the immediate family was in the front. And she had asked that the junior minister at their Adventist church, they were Seventh-day Adventists. Now, you're talking about the strict people. These are strict folks. But she had asked that the junior minister do the sermon for her funeral. And he said, I've entitled this sermon for Mrs. Stewart, The Best Is Yet to Come. And what he began to do is tell about her life, coming up poor from a family of 16, her involvement in the church, but most of all, her involvement with foster care. And he recounted how many hundreds of children that she had reached out to, brought into her home, and assisted in their lives. And many of them went to the wayside just like I did, but many of them grew up and became good people. But the key point was that she had done something positive in her life for people who were downtrodden, these kids that had nobody to take care of. And that same principle that I used to abhor and that I was so jealous of and that I resented so much, in my recovery, I could understand the value of this woman. and it filled my heart so much. I had tears in my eyes, and they were streaming down my face. But they weren't tears of sadness. They were tears of joy. Because for the first time in my life, I understood this woman. I understood her depth. I understood her dedication. And I understood her love. And it took me that long to get to that point. You have to go a lot of roads to get to one little point sometimes. I left there. I came back. Years later, that same brother called me and he says, our father is starting to fade into dementia, and I need a power of attorney so I can take care of him. And I signed over a power of attorney so that he could take care of my father. I couldn't pretend that I was going to ever be close with my family because I wasn't. My life was here in California, and it would stay here. My brother never wanted to come back, and my father and mother never wanted to visit out here. So that's what happened. He began to take care of my dad. And for the next 9 years, he took care of him hand and foot. Hand and foot. Changed his diapers. Fed him. Took care of him. Made sure everything was taken care of for him. Until he couldn't do it anymore. I got a call one day. I was on my way home, and they said, the call said, you need to call your brother. He has something to talk to you about. So I got off the freeway, and I went into a place, and I made a call to him. And what he told me at that point in time was, he said, I need to tell you, Bob, that our father was dead. And he began to explain to me. He was in tears. I could hear the tears in his voice. I could hear the tears and how he was straining to tell me what had happened. And he explained to me that he struggled to make this call to let me know what was going on. In fact, he struggled for 2 weeks to call me. And I wanted to get angry, but I couldn't get angry because I wasn't there. I didn't take care of my father. He said, you know, the last time you were here, Bob, we were really struggling, and that was a couple of years ago, and it got worse and worse. And then one day I got up and I went to change Dad's diaper, and all the 8 years prior to this incident, I never smelled anything, but this one day I just couldn't do it anymore. And I had to put him in a nursing home. And 9 months later, in that nursing home, he just faded away into a fetal position. And he said, I cremated him, and I interned him along with Mom. And I hope I did the right thing. And I said, you know what, man? You have been the son I could never be. You're a much better man than I was ever capable of being. If there's anything that I can do to help, let me know. The one thing you always have for me is my respect and my love. I'll never be close with him, but I can certainly respect that he stood up and stepped up to the plate. I went back there a couple months later, and I asked my brother to give me directions to the cemetery where they were buried. And he got up and went to work to his job early in the morning, left a note on the kitchen table with directions. And I got up and I drove up probably about 15 miles away from where he lived to where the cemetery was. And I figured, well, there's always a flower shop close to the cemetery, so I'll find a flower shop, get some, a couple of bouquets of flowers, and take them back to the gravesite, which is what I did. A couple of those little gravesites. And cheap vases and flowers. I went to the office and they said, okay, here's where they are. Mr. and Mrs. Stewart are over here, this plot, this section, this number. And I went and I looked for the plot and I couldn't find it. I went back to the office. And The lady said, oh, no, that's where it is. Let me run by you again. She told me again. I went out. I looked. I couldn't find it. So the third time, she said, here, I'll take you out. It was like taking a little six-year-old by the hand. And she took me out to the plot. And right when she said, this is their plot, she turned around and was headed back to the office. I looked down. And there was no headstone. And my immediate emotion was that I got enraged and angry. And I stood there for about 20 seconds with this anger bubbling up inside of me. And I was standing in the shade of a tree and the sun was coming through the branches and shining down on this empty spot. And I started to repeat the serenity prayer. I must have said it about 10 or 15 times. And that crack happened. And what the crack was that, Bob, your ninth step was not complete. You need to go in there and order that headstone right now. And that's what I did. I went in and ordered a double headstone, told them what I wanted on them, and said, when you got it in place, send me a picture. So I'll know that they now have something to identify where they're resting. That's the least I could do. I was the prodigal son. I was the one that wandered all over the place. It was only because I have recovery in Narcotics Anonymous that I was allowed and given the privilege to do that. You know, one of the most important things in recovery is sponsorship. I want to talk a little bit about sponsorship. I don't know, you know, I've read everything they've said about sponsorship in the pamphlet, sponsorship, the book about experiences, all of the stuff. But the one thing that I always hold near and dear to me is that I believe that sponsorship is the most sacred trust we have in Narcotics Anonymous. It's our ability to share with another human being on a level that is only shared by that person with us, and that we share with another human being that we've allowed to hear everything that we needed to let go of. You see, my first sponsor, man, was a he's one of them old school guys that we didn't have a basic text when I came to Narcotics Anonymous. I'm one of those dinosaurs today that's privileged to have come along at the time when the fellowship was getting on fire to have their own stuff. They were tired of hanging on to the apron string. They wanted a book of their own. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I embraced this idea in the beginning. I was one of them guys that when you told me to put that other stuff away and get it out of that meeting, I wanted to tape your head off. So I had to learn how to trust the process. But what I believe is that that trust, that sacred trust, it began with that first sponsor. I was able to do something that I advise everybody in this room to do if you haven't done it. And what that is whatever your deepest, darkest secret is, you need to give it up. You need to give it up. Through my relationship with that man, I was able to give up my deep, dark, the one that I said I would carry to my grave, I gave him up. And you know what? I've been free of them demons ever since. I have not had to look over my shoulder ever since. They're gone. It's those people that come here that hang on to those secrets, that believe that we will not love you, we will not care about you, and we will despise you if you tell the truth about who you are. That's a fallacy. That's bullshit. It's those people that end up going back over and over and over again. I lived with one for 18 years. Could not give up the deepest secrets. Refused to get honest with herself. And was destined to be chronically relapsed. Have long periods of wonderful recovery. Well, let's say wonderful abstinence. Because recovery begins when the truth starts. And then horrible relapses. And then, like I said, I had to live that nightmare that my friend lived at 17 years clean. And that's to watch your loved one chronically relapse. And not only did I watch it then, I watched it at 25 years clean. Until I found myself standing in front of the county jail out in Banning, California, waiting in line in the drizzling rain to go visit on the telephone with my wife. And I thought to myself, another crack happened. What the fuck am I doing out here doing this? I've been clean for 25 years and I'm standing out in the county jail line waiting to visit and she's not willing to do anything it takes to stay clean. You know, my sponsor had said at one point in time, and I think we all tell our sponsees the same thing, give it a try. See what you can do to help this person. But there comes a time when you can't help them no more. The person who needs the most help is you. I needed some help. So I had to reach out for some help. But the first thing I had to do was make a decision that that was going to change, that my life was going to change. I went to speak at a meeting in Anaheim, California on a Saturday night. That lady right there was giving my wife a 7-year cake that night. And that's where I met my wife, Renee. We became friends first. We became friends. She had to understand and believe that I was done with what was going on in my life and that I was ready to turn over a new leaf. And I had to make that decision and to make it firm and fast. And that was not a pleasant thing to do. Very difficult. My sponsees, these knuckleheads out here in the Inland Empire, carried me through a lot of these dark days. We used to have wonderful times at my house. We would barbecue and deep fry turkeys and do all kind of shit. Yard work, big time. I had a bird farm out there. And if anybody's had a bird farm, you know you got work to do. So I had a lot of helpers. You got some step work done, come on out here, man. But before we start, pick up that hoe. Pick up that rake over there. We got a weed eater, let's go chop this field down out here. But we did things together, and you know what? We bonded. You know what? We make fun of it and we laugh about it, but we became close. And when I was going through these dark periods, man, I did something I'd never done or said I would never do in my life one day. The insanity had got so great. I said, you know what, I'll never call this woman sponsor, but that was bullshit. I got on the phone one day and I called Kathy and I said, hey, you need to come down here because this shit is getting crazy. And she said, don't tell her I'm coming. We're going to show up as a surprise. And then you and Rick can go off somewhere and then we'll see what's going on. And just like I came out there for Rick that day, they came down there for me that day. And they showed up. It didn't alleviate it, but it gave me an understanding. It gave me some clarity. And that's what we do. We reach out for people. We keep the sacred trust. Everybody's business is nobody's business. what you share with me stays with me. And I can tell you, I've had some sponsees where I've prayed to God that let this shit not come to me, but through me. I don't want to keep it. And the God of my understanding has been willing to do that. Let it come through me and not to me. We've exchanged our experiences with one another. If someone shares something with me that they are ashamed of, I let them know there's things about me that I'm ashamed of, that I did, that I'm not proud of. No one is any better than anybody else. Two years after my divorce was final, I was sitting at my office and I got a phone call from my ex-wife's brother. And he asked me, "Are you sitting down, Bob?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sitting down." And I knew immediately what he was going to tell me. And what he told me was that he had gotten a call from his mother that the mobile home manager where my ex-wife had the mobile home, the manager was concerned because they hadn't seen her in a while. And they called her mother, who was the emergency contact number, to say, "We want the sheriffs to go and investigate the house because we're concerned." And the mother, being like she was, vacillated on the decision and called her son, and he had to make the decision. And he told the sheriffs to go ahead and go in and investigate, and what they found that she was dead in that house. And not only was she dead in that house, that it was estimated that she'd been dead in there almost a month. Which is a point about isolation and active addiction. You know, the disease does not want you to have a circle of love around you. It wants you to first get rid of that outer circle of acquaintances, then get rid of the next circle of close friends, and then it wants you to abandon that circle of family until it has you isolated into just a single body. And that's when the disease goes to work to do that final coup de grace. Take you out. Kill you. That's what it wants to do. And it did that. The sad situation, but it was almost predictable. Because she had made a decision that she didn't want what we had to offer. Not only had she made that decision, she made that comment to me, to my face. "I don't give a damn about that program and the people anymore. I'm doing what I want to do. I'm having fun." We have a lot of fun on our way to hell. You know, the gift of Narcotics Anonymous is that our predecessors saw things that we as little misses have no way of knowing and no way of seeing. When you think about in 1953, when they petitioned that other fellowship for the rights to adapt the steps and traditions, they didn't change the language in the first step to say that we were powerless over drugs. It says we were powerless over our addiction and our lives had become unmanageable. In 1953, the word addiction was not used, not even clinically, especially with addicts. They didn't talk about it. They were saying things like, "You're a dope fiend." Why do you think we got the name Narcotics Anonymous? Because all drugs were classified as narcotics. The miracle was that they could see ahead and say, "We're not concerned about the material thing, the substance. We're concerned about the disease. And it doesn't matter what you take. This program will work for you." I heard people say it earlier today. This fellowship has changed tremendously over the last 30-something years. I mean, when I got here, it was heroin addicts primarily. If anything else popped up in here, they were an anomaly. They were strange. Where the hell did they come from? Because it was dope fiends up in here. And the sad thing is we look down on others. And that's a part of our disease. You know, like, I can remember in San Francisco standing on the corner with a bunch of dope fiends looking across the street at the liquor store at 6 o'clock in the morning waiting for it to open up and saying, look at them winos over there. I'll never be one of them. The heroin addict looks down at the speed freak. The speed freak looks down at the pothead. The pothead looks down at the wino. We're all the same. It's one disease. We all die as a result of it. I got a telephone call yesterday. This is how the phone call went. I answered the phone and I said, this is Bob. Can I help you? I said, Bobby, this is Mickey. Now, nobody calls me Bobby except for my childhood. And I'm trying to say, now who the hell is Mickey? He said, this is Mickey. This is Ralph's brother. His biological brother. This is Mickey. So I said, what's going on? How you doing? He said, I need to call and tell you what's going on with Ralph. I said, what's going on? I talked to him about 9 months ago, and he had had another operation. I think he told me at that time, he said, I just had another operation, and they took my voice box. Because when he was talking to me, when Ralph was talking to me on the phone, he had his finger over the hole in his throat so he could talk to me like this. And he said, I'm doing okay. So Mickey said, I needed to call and tell you that you put Ralph in a hospice because he's dying of cancer. You see, Ralph, and it was revealed to me by Mickey that Ralph had given him power of attorney, just like I gave Ralph power of attorney for our father. Ralph started having operations for throat cancer 20-some years ago, and he's had over 6 operations. But he held his mud. He never said a word about it. And I asked him, can I call and talk to him? He said, you can't talk anymore. But you can text him. I was over to visit him today, and he's walking around and going outside and getting some sunshine. But he's terminal. He worked for the Cleveland Clinic as a driver, and again, driving patients for him to their appointments. And the Cleveland Clinic put him in a hospice, one of the best hospices they had on the west side of Cleveland. That is free. They don't charge anything. They're non-profit. And they take the best of care. But you see, in my heart, I have a great sadness. Because he and I were never close. And we never would be close. Because the reality was, he was a child when I left. He was an infant. And the only time he saw me was in the midst of my insanity and the reprieve that I had in the penitentiary, but he did get to see me when I was clean and in recovery. And one of the last conversations I had with Ralph before they took the last of his voice box was he called me, we talked, I called him and we talked. And he said, Bob, I'm ashamed to tell you this. And I said, what you ashamed of, man? He said, I had this throat operation, man, and the only way I could ease the pain is I started smoking weed again. Well, he ain't okay. And I said, and? He said, they were looking for somebody in my building, and they smelled, the police was in my building looking for somebody to smell for weeks coming out of my apartment, and they busted me. And I got a case, and they gave me probation, and I got to go to East Plant. So, well, that's good, man. That's good. You don't do that wrong, man. But he was ashamed, you know. He wanted to be a minister. He went back to college when he was in his 30s to get a divinity degree. But he ended up being a teacher. But because the economy is so bad, they don't pay anybody, he went back to driving trucks again. I don't know how this story is going to end, but I know in my heart that he has a special place for what he did. You know. And these are the gifts that I've been given in my recovery. I've been given sadness, but I've been given joy. You know, I have a wonderful woman in my life today who I respect and love tremendously. When we were together about a month and a half, she bought me this bracelet, and she had it engraved on the inside. And it says this, "In for the long haul." I got that same feeling about Narcotics Anonymous. I've been in for the long haul, and I will be in for the long haul. If you're a newcomer around here and you don't have a sponsor, then you need to get one quick. You need to rush. Hurry up. Put a rush order in. Get you a sponsor. Because if you're trying to guide yourself through this thing, you will have nothing but insanity in your life, because that's what's teaching you, your own insanity. You need to get some help, get some guidance. You need to get involved in this fellowship, even if it's just getting to a meeting early and setting up some chairs. In the old days, we'd get there early, set up chairs, and we could smoke in meetings, so we washed ashtrays, cleaned out cups, did mop floors in Venice. I mopped that floor, I don't know how many times. Do something. Contribute. Be of service. Don't always have your hand out. If you give to this fellowship, it will give to you. Get honest with yourself. You know, self-deception is the greatest gift, the greatest thief that we have, and that's what will take your life and take you out of here, self-deception. You know, if you continue lying to yourself about who you are, what you are, and what you're about, and what you believe and what you don't believe, and keep those secrets, I guarantee you that the disease will find a way to take you right out that door. And there is no guarantee that you'll get back in here. You know, I've seen a lot of people come in and out, and a lot of times I question that, but sometimes, you know, you just have to let it go. Some people are given the gift of revolving door policy. And they stay alive. And eventually, they get it. You know, there was a guy who used to come to a meeting on Friday in Venice, and his wife brought him every Friday for 2 years. And he slobbered on his shoe tops every Friday. He was nodding, dipping. And then about a year and a half after I didn't see him anymore, I went down to the treatment center I went through, and there he was a counselor. And he was clean and Narcotics Anonymous. So you never know who's going to get it. What he was hearing in his stupor. But he got it. This is a gift. This program is a gift. I'd like to thank the committee that asked me to come out and speak. You know, you put me in a hell of a jackpot coming in here behind Kathy and Rick and Weddle and all. And that was a jackpot situation. But you know what? I'm up to the challenge today. Because it's all about the truth. We all have our truths. And we tell our truths. I don't worry about what I'm saying or how I sound or none of that stuff today. I try to get honest with Bob, because when I step down from here in a minute or so, I'm going to feel some relief about what I had to share about what was going on in my life. Because I shared it with you. And the person who got the most out of it was me. Again, I'm Bob and I'm an addict, and thank you for letting me know.
Thank give it up for Bob one more time.